Evan John Kearns died in December of 2022, at the very young age of only 64. His death was unexpected and has left many with great sorrow. Kevin was a remarkable man, smart, creative, talented, adventurous, caring, and also very giving. He was also a man full of great faith. Kevin possessed a great wisdom, and especially after surviving cancer, his ability to see life with deep clarity was very evident. Kevin's impact on the lives of others was not only numerous, but transformative. He freely, willingly, and so often shared his gifts with those who crossed his path, and that sharing encompassed many different countries. Kevin and his brothers decided to write a book a few years back, detailing some of their life experiences and their gained wisdom. Here are a few of the stories that Kevin included in the book. They're brief stories, 10 in all, written by Kevin, and luckily we have it recorded in his own voice. I hope you enjoy these stories as much as we do.
Growing up in an agricultural area, it was quite common for summer work to somehow involve fruit. Especially when we were younger, and not being old enough to possess a driver's license, made the thought of venturing out to secure a job on our own a dream that would have to wait a few years. When I was 14 years old, the age range of the six boys ran from me to the youngest brother, Dan, who was 2 at the time. Our dad usually taught summer school, which was a blessing for him, since he could stay indoors many of the days that reached the high 90 degrees, and often north of 100. This only lasted part of the summer, though, and once the summer session ended, Mom was more than ready to get a break from staying home watching all six boys. Since Dad taught practically year-round, this was her only chance to get out, and even still, she took the opportunity to help a few of us experience the value of a strong work ethic. Picking prunes was about the only work that unskilled boys could hope for at those young ages, but even that menial work had a minimum age. I was 14, Tim was 12, and Terry was 10, which was the cutoff. Pat, Mike, and Dan were still too young, so they missed all the fun and stayed home with Dad. Mom had to convince the orchard boss to let us pick as a family. I think he knew we would be lucky to fill even one bin a day, but since we were sent out to gather the fruit that was left behind after the shaker had collected the majority, what did he have to lose? I think he also felt a little sorry for us, but respected our desire to try. Mom was required to drive us out there each day and stay with us as our supervisor, so we were just an afterthought anyway. We were not very good at picking prunes off the ground. It was slow work, and we were either in a bend-over position or down on our knees with our buckets. The hardened clods of dirt pressed through our thin jeans, and it was hard to decide which was worse, our sore backs or painful knees. I guess it didn't matter. We soon had both anyway. Now, Mom was not good at picking, not at all. God bless her for spending those days in the hot orchards with us just so we could earn a little money. We were equally fortunate they didn't charge us for the fruit she ate. She easily consumed more than she picked, and by midday, she often could be found sitting against a tree in the shade, catching a bit of shut-eye. Well, not just sitting, since you probably know what effect prunes can have on the digestive tract, but that's a story for another time. Now, normally we would just continue to work through Mom's nap, but one day I decided to try my hand at driving the truck. I didn't have a license, but Dad had let me steer a few times, and come on, if Mom could do it, so could I. Gently disturbing Mom from her dreamscape, I mentioned I needed to go get water, and whether she realized that meant I was taking the truck, I didn't want to clarify. Tim and Terry were both eager to take a break from picking and jumped at the chance to share in the adventure. I slid in behind the wheel, Tim into the passenger side, and Terry hopped into the bed of the little Datsun pickup. The orchard was pretty isolated, so no one would be able to see us, and the border and gravel road stretched for quite a long way. I'm sure we weren't going nearly as fast as it felt, but the thrill added to the perception of many additional miles per hour. After driving for several minutes, we decided to turn around and head back. For some unknown reason at the time, we yelled at Terry to change from standing in the bed of the truck and join us in the cab. Although seatbelts were never a consideration, our three bodies jammed together would prove life-saving in very short order. Confidence in my superior driving skills overflowing now, I decided to pick up the pace. Little did I know that gravel, sharp right turns, and excessive speed would result in such a rude awakening. Halfway into the turn, which was halfway too late, the centrifugal force caused our truck to assume anything but an upright position. When we came to a stop, we got out, and still in shock, we were just thankful that Terry had made the move to the front. He surely would have been killed when we flipped over, or hurt very badly at best. So looking back, I'm sure divine intervention held us securely in the palm of his hand. With nothing more than bruises, my ego getting the worst of it, we now had to face Mom. And scarier, eventually Dad. How are we going to explain an innocent water-gathering effort resulted in totaling our only family transportation? I had the brilliant idea to blame it on the rabbit that ran in front, causing me to swerve out of the way to protect his life. Mom loved animals. She would surely understand. We walked back to her sleeping tree and shared our story. I don't know if she believed us, but her love for her sons focused on being thankful we were okay. I don't remember how Mom was able to reach Dad. This was long before cell phones, and I have no idea how we got home since there wasn't a second family car. But I do recall thinking we were out of the woods since my story of the rascally wabbit being the culprit seemed unquestioned. That is, until we had to make the police report for the insurance claim. We had to go into the police station to make the report, and I quickly found myself eye to eye, nose to nose with the policeman, who just wasn't seeming to want to accept my story. He kept asking me the same questions repeatedly, and then pulled out a thick black book filled with laws. He asked me to read one paragraph that simply said something along the lines of it being unlawful to lie to a policeman. He then asked me again about the rabbit, and I tearfully confessed there was no rabbit. It had been a squirrel. No, just kidding. I expressed sorrow for lying and took full responsibility. I think they knew all along, but they played it well. I expected Dad to throw the book at me. At the very least, swing the family wooden paddle a few times. But Dad being Dad, the amazing, loving father God blessed us with, he simply expressed his disappointment that I lied, and said I would have to find a way to repay the insurance deductible. And then he hugged me and said how thankful he was that I wasn't hurt, that none of his boys were hurt. I don't think I ever paid that deductible, and I never look at prunes the same way. I am a little more cautious on gravel roads to this day, but most of all, I'm just thankful Terry got in the front seat. We didn't grow up poor. We were rich in so many ways. We had two very loving parents who married as young sweethearts and stayed married their entire lives. When Dad passed away, at some point we asked Mom if she would ever remarry, and she said of course not. Dad and Jesus were the only men she needed in her life. And the riches were exemplified in many other ways. We had decent schools. My brothers and I were blessed with above-average athleticism. Some of the brothers were way above average, even bordering on great. Not me. God played a very healthy role in our lives. All in all, we were wealthy in many ways, just not money or materialistic possessions. Don't get me wrong. Our house was decent. We had daily meals consistently. And we did seem to always have a functional car. But there was only so much our dad could provide working as a teacher and supporting a full-time homemaking wife and six boys. The thing is, we lived in an area where our financial standing didn't matter to most people, and I think as a result, we didn't notice that we probably had less than most of the others when it came to possessions. We stayed pretty close to home, close to each other, so it just never was apparent. Well, most of the time, that is. Time does a great job sanding the rough edges of growing up. Most memories meld together, and recollection is usually balanced overall with remembering growing up as typically pretty good. There are some occasions, though, that forever stand out. I remember preparing for my first scout camping trip. I had never camped in my life, and the thought of venturing out and spending a night away from home seemed awesome. We were told to pack certain essentials and meet on Saturday in the school parking lot to load up. I had zero experience preparing, so I asked my dad what I should do. I told him I thought I needed a backpack, but he suggested that might be too much since it was just one night. He tossed me a pillowcase and said I could easily fit anything I needed to bring inside, and it would be lighter and easier to carry. Looking back, I know he just didn't have any extra money to buy a backpack, but at the time I had no clue, so I just believed him. Saturday morning arrived, and I grabbed my pillowcase backpack and raced to the school parking lot. Everyone was working together to load all the gear into the back of the pickup trucks. When it came time for me to hand my pack to the guy loading, I was happy to see it was one of my very good friends, Jay. He took it from me and slung it over to another guy who would catch it and stack it with the others. Everything was going great until that second guy caught my pack and shouted out, "What the heck is this? A pillowcase?" I don't know why I hadn't noticed until then. Everyone else had backpacks except me. My friend Jay quickly yelled at the guy that it was my backpack. Shut up and just load it with the rest. I'll always remember that moment fondly, and thankfully he was there. As life would have it, the rest of the trip went well, and there weren't any consequences with my pillowcase. Oddly, the impact of that experience would be felt not that weekend, but much later, and many times, in fact. Although the pillowcase had almost no impact that weekend, many times later in life I reflect on that time, reflecting on how my dad must have felt like he let me down a little by not being able to afford a backpack. I wish I could have told him then not to worry, and that he already provided more than anyone could hope for, more than I could ever thank him for. And the older I got, the more I came to appreciate what he did for us and how wealthy we were. I also find myself remembering that even though I must have stood out as the pillowcase backpacker, that occasion came and went, had no ill effect on my life, and life just carried on. At times when I start to worry that I might stand out for the wrong reasons, or might not be measuring up to someone else's standards, I think it's probably just my imagination. And even if it's not, who cares? In time, no one will remember anyway. Besides, that was a very cool pillowcase. I learned of a horse auction that was coming up and got excited about the possibility of acquiring a great horse. The situation was not ideal due to the shelter-at-home restrictions related to COVID-19, so this auction would be held completely online. The ranch was a very well-known, respectable source for good horses, but good sense recommends seeing the horse before you buy, especially because there are no returns. And this ranch is in Wyoming, so getting there would be a bit tricky. Nonetheless, they seemed to have nice horses, one in particular, so I thought I would try. I figured since the auction was only online, and virtual buying probably was considered risky by most, that maybe this was a chance to get a bargain. I don't have much experience buying horses, but I thought if I set my budget reasonable for the risk, what could I lose? I decided $8,000 would be my max bid. A bit of a stretch financially, but if I could get Monty, my favorite horse, it would be worth the risk. The day came for the auction. I had been up all night imagining I would surely get Monty, since I was willing to go all the way up to $8,000. I wrestled with trying to find answers to all the questions. How would I get him home to California from Wyoming? Where would I put him? How would I explain to my trainer that I bought him online when she had consistently told me that was insane? My brother Tim and partner Carol gathered with me around the computer, ready to start the bidding. We had drinks and snacks and were preparing to celebrate. We were all nervous, and then the bidding began. Well, I'm not sure if I ever saw the $8,000 mark come and go, but in no time, Monty had sold for over $40,000. Apparently that is not uncommon for these horses, but I had no idea. I vacillated between disappointment and embarrassment. Dreaming had been fun, but reality kicked me in the shins for sure. Oddly, though, that experience awoke a memory that I had buried deep and had long forgotten. It took me back over 50 years, back to my Cub Scout days, Pinewood Derby days specifically. That time is a bit bleary, somewhat fuzzy, but certain events remain crystal clear. Pinewood Derby is one of those. Social media at the time consisted mainly of the telephone and the U.S. mail, so until the day of the Derby race, no one would know what anyone else was doing, and each person's race car was a secret only to be unveiled when time to compete. I can remember working so hard on that car, night after night, carving from a single block of wood, sanding every angle, doing anything I could to make it lighter and more aerodynamic. My dad wanted to help, but I was confident I had the knack. And parents helping wasn't supposed to be allowed anyway. I remember painting it red, a bright, fiery red. Looking back, I had no idea what I was doing, and at most, followed the directions to build the most basic of cars. But what did I know? I had no one to compare to, no baseline with which to measure. My brothers were all younger, so no one had ventured down this road yet. What I did have, though, was a very active imagination. I just knew I would win. I was going to crush the competition. Everyone would want me to help them build their cars next year. My dad was going to be so proud of me. I was definitely going to be the talk of the competition. Race day came, and I recall wrapping up my car, taking great care not to scratch the paint or throw off the alignment of the plastic wheels. The race was at Johnson Park School, our neighborhood school only a few blocks away. So I walked there, anxious with excitement, barely containing myself. I would try to be somewhat humble when I won, wanting to be sensitive to how hard others probably worked on their cars, but no promises. As I entered the school gym, I was dumbfounded. Where did all these beautiful cars come from? Why did mine all of a sudden look so plain? Surely their fathers must have helped. Heck, they must have used all their aerospace engineering talent to take over and build their darn cars. Well, maybe mine didn't stand out in the looks department, but we still did have a race to run. Confidence a bit battered, I was still hopeful mine would be competitive in the speed department. Maybe even place for an award. We set our cars on the top of the track, fingers crossed, and praying silently that God would give mine a bit of a push. Not a lot, just enough to win. I would stay humble, I promised him. Ready, set, go, and off they went. Wow, they went fast. Well, not mine, but all the others. Amazing how quickly reality stole the show. I'm glad all my hopes, all my optimism, wishful thinking ahead of time had been my secret. My embarrassment would be something only I would know, but it hurt. I remember gathering my car and walking home. I did not walk fast, but I remember thinking I was still traveling faster than my speed racer had made it down that track. Walking through the front door, I was met by my dad. He just smiled and commended me for doing my best. I don't know why for sure, but for some reason at that moment, everything was okay. I think it is still important to dream. Pursuing lofty goals, setting your bar high, and reaching is a good thing. Funny how two incidents, several decades apart, would still underscore that ultimately, reality still wins out in the end. But we can have fun along the way. And maybe there is a lesson or two to be learned besides not having me build your Pinewood Derby car. If you would have asked me early on what I wanted to be when I grew up, I probably would have said a doctor. That would have made my parents proud for sure. And the alternative parent-pleasing answer would have been a priest, but at that age, I didn't think that was in the cards. I might have also wished to be a pro athlete, but even then I think I was pretty clear on my limitations. Life played out, as it always does, and eventually I found myself in college and had to declare a major. Somehow, I made it through the years and still wanted to be a doctor, so I chose biology as my major, chemical science as my minor, and trusted this would provide a solid path to medical school. I completed my college education and even included a stint at the National Institute of Health doing cancer research, which would hopefully help my entree into a medical school somewhere. My plan was taking shape. Underscore my plan, though, since it would not be long before God would make it clear he had another path in mind. My girlfriend for the last 2 years of college attended school intending to obtain an MRS degree. I was completely unaware of that motivation until near the end of my term, and when I hesitated to commit, refused to commit, she ended our relationship. She left school and returned home to the San Francisco Bay Area. In hindsight, I should have left her decision alone, completed my schooling, and tried to attend medical school as planned. But whether I thought we were meant to be, or it was more my ego not being able to handle the rejection, I decided to put med school on hold briefly and find a job close to her to win her back. Emporium Capwell, a large retail store back then, had a management training program that would guarantee I'd be located near San Francisco. So this was going to be the perfect solution to my challenge. I was sure I only needed to be near her consistently for a few weeks, and I would salvage my relationship and be able to return to my medical plans. Once again, my plan and God's plan were a bit askew, and guess which one went on and out? As life would have it, I took the job at Emporium Capital and never saw my girlfriend again. But for the first time in many years, I was experiencing life without homework and decided to enjoy a little longer. This went on for 3 years. I did reach a point that I felt a little guilty not making use of my science degree, but rather than try to return to the med school path, I knew I was no longer disciplined enough to make it through, I decided to take a job selling surgical lasers and microscopes for Zeiss. Yes, I was quite qualified to handle the science aspect, but no, I was anything but qualified or disciplined to handle the outside sales component. My territory was large, and my customers were nurses and doctors. Who knew they liked to be entertained so much, and I did have an expense account. But after a full year in the position, I had not made a single sale, so it was time to find a different calling. I had always wanted to fly planes, so it only made sense to try and join the Navy as a fighter pilot. Lo and behold, I got accepted to the Navy's flight program, AOCS, so I packed my bags and prepared to commit to at least the next 7 years of my life to this latest pursuit. Off I went to Pensacola, Florida. My plan was taking shape, or so I thought. God had a different plan, though, and a week later I was back home and out of the Navy. That's a story for another time, but this did start a journey that would make sense until many years later. Unprepared to be home, having thought my next several years were planned out, I tried several endeavors. I sold insurance benefit packages. Well, tried to sell. I wasn't any good at it. I did have a job working for the 7-Eleven Corporation, and that was okay for a couple years, but then decided to give sales a try again and was allured by the temptation of making big money in commercial real estate. Alas, it was clear now that I did not possess the sales gene. What I was beginning to see, though, was just how important relationships were in business and in life. My commercial broker job didn't pan out, but along the way, I would meet people who would help me in surprising ways. One was a property manager who I got along quite well with and who also was married to someone I'd worked with at 7-Eleven. God's dominoes were beginning to line up, although it would still be quite some time before his game would be revealed. I knew I could no longer survive the commercial real estate gig. As it was, I'd made no money in over a year and only survived by supplementing with a nighttime waiter job. I reached out to my property management friend to ask for a job and was told that, although she liked me, having no direct experience would make my hire a very long shot. A bit disappointed, I decided to take a break, obtain a passport, and go visit my brother Tim, who was stationed in Okinawa. At this point, I had nothing to lose and no compelling options, so what the heck? The day before I was to depart, I got a call from my property management friend. She shared that this never happens, but an opportunity came up for an entry-level assistant manager position on one of her properties. The open opportunity was sure not to last, so I needed to interview quickly. I told her I was leaving for Okinawa the next day, so it had to be that day, and somehow she was able to schedule an interview with the hiring manager. I threw on the only tie I owned and dashed to the interview. It didn't last long, and although I thought we got along well, I certainly wasn't overconfident that I would be chosen. And I had a plane to catch anyway, so off I went, unemployed and thinking I would enjoy time with my brother and then figure things out when I returned. After 2 weeks in Okinawa, also a story for another time, I returned and fully prepared to start from scratch and try to figure out my new path. Long before voicemail, I checked my answering machine when I got home and shockingly listened as my friend told me they wanted to hire me for the assistant manager position. Holy moly, what a shock, what a relief, and little did I know what an opportunity that would be, a stepping stone to something much bigger. I spent the next decade learning the commercial real estate business. I enjoyed the work, but it was the relationships that I formed along the way that would make the difference. I was working as a landlord, and one of the commercial brokers that I used as a partner to help lease office space decided to leave the business. Unlike me, he was very successful, so deciding to leave was surprising, but he ended up at a little startup company called eBay as their marketing director. As they grew, they decided they needed to hire a real estate manager, and since my former broker was the only one who had any real estate experience, they turned to him for a suggested candidate. We had always got along well, so he threw my name in the mix. Even though I had no corporate real estate experience, because of his recommendation, I was offered an interview. Not sure if it was because of his reference, my fudging a bit on my experience, divine intervention, or a combination of all, somehow I was offered the job. A job that would become a career that spanned over 2 decades, take me to over 40 countries, and more importantly, put me in a position to help so many people. Working for a tech company meant the salary would be okay, but it also came with stock options. These would prove quite valuable, especially when associated with a company on an insane growth curve. Far from rich, but the added income would allow me to share so much and do so much good. Helping to resurrect a Catholic church that was struggling, funding many charitable endeavors, and most importantly, being there to help my brothers when needed. Truly a blessing from God, a blessing for which I am daily, eternally grateful. A long, twisted path no one could have ever seen coming. Well, almost no one. Trust God's plan. It always works out for the best, eventually. Growing up, I can't recall a time my brothers and I weren't together. I am the oldest of 6 boys, so Mom and Dad creating all 6 of us didn't happen overnight. I vaguely remember times in the very early days when we had only the beginnings of the family. Memories most likely strengthened by the photos I am so lucky to have from those days more than 5 decades ago. Although it is a bit of a blur, I distinctly remember occasions when the family was together. Just not crystal clear how many brothers were involved each time. Tim, being brother number 2, is relevant in most of my early recollections. Makes sense since I ruled my childhood world, being the only child until he invaded my paradise. And then they just kept coming. Being Catholic, Mom and Dad felt compelled to build a family, and in less than 12 years, I had 5 younger brothers. My brothers as adults are not nearly as mysterious to me as their childhood selves. In these later years, we have done a better job connecting, and surprised some people with just how close we've remained over time. It is through this evolving connecting that I have learned that I had some pretty amazing younger brothers growing up, but seems I missed a good portion of the journey. And honestly, I don't know why. When I think back to those times, nothing jumps out as a compelling reason. I don't remember deciding my life didn't have time for my brothers. So how did I miss my youngest brother pitching no-hitters or winning MVP of basketball tournaments, all 5'3" of him? How did I miss my brother Mike, diving off the starting block of a swimming sprint in his Speedo? Tim and Terry excelling at multiple sports. And I would have loved to watch Pat wrestle. It's like they had entire childhoods that I missed, but I don't think I was gone, so not sure how that happened. I try not to regret much in life. Learn from mistakes, try to do better, but if you can't change something, not much use lamenting about it. But I do regret missing my brothers growing up. I, like anyone else, don't know when my last day on this earth will be, but I am confident I am closer to that day than to the day I was born. Otherwise, I'd have to live past 120, and that doesn't seem a part of God's script for my life story. As a result, I am much more conscious of my mortality these days. One question I have been asking myself lately is, if I knew the actual day that any one of my brothers would die, and certainly if it was any time soon, would I treat them any different than I do now? Would I spend more time with them? Would I talk to them in ways or about topics that we avoid now? When I catch myself thinking that I have time, time to make up for missed opportunities, time to catch up later, all I need to do is think about my time with my dad. It has been a hard lesson to learn about the risk of putting conversations and moments off to a time in the future that never comes. I waited too late with my dad. I never expected him to die suddenly, thinking I had several more years with him, and I have regretted it ever since. I need to do better with my brothers. I don't want to miss any more of them growing up. They are all a blessing from God in my life, and I need to treat them accordingly. I want to know them better, and I know I only have today. I didn't think of my parents as being any different than other parents growing up. They seemed quite normal, even ordinary at times. We didn't have a lot of money. How could we, with Dad being a school teacher and Mom a homemaker, together raising 6 boys, but we also didn't want for much. We had simple lives, but they were safe and full. Our parents weren't high school sweethearts in the typical sense. Dad was 8 years older than Mom, so they weren't in high school together as students. But he was her high school teacher, so in a way, they were high school sweethearts, just a bit controversial. Over time, they confirmed the pureness of their relationship, though, as they were each other's first and only marriage. They stayed married for over 40 years, created a beautiful family of 6 boys, and together overcame every challenge God placed in their path. I was 9 years old when we first discovered Mom had what would one day be known as manic depression or bipolar disease. At the time, we had no idea what caused her to just go crazy periodically and then follow up with severe depression. The first time it happened, I remember her ending up in a mental hospital in Berkeley, complete with a padded cell and electric shock therapy. I do remember being scared, wondering if she would ever get better and if we had lost our mom for good, but Dad never gave up hope. He loved her so deeply. Over the years, we became quite familiar with the mental disease, and begrudgingly so did our neighbors. Thankfully, with the advancement of a medical science, she was able to keep the episodes somewhat in check. The frequency, intensity, and duration of the occurrences declined. This was over many years, though, and I know it took a toll on my dad. It wasn't easy on us either, but we always had our dad to lead us, and her, out of the darkness. I don't know how he did it, how he never stopped loving her, how he never gave up, no matter how many times my mom's affliction reared its ugly head, all too often in the most inopportune times. The beast would come out of nowhere, sometimes in a very public way, totally embarrass us boys, but Dad never seemed fazed. He just loved her so much. He was such a superhero, but he was only human. I vividly remember one time that has stuck in my memory all these years. I can see it so clearly. Mom had just finished one of her more trying episodes, and my dad was just spent emotionally and physically. We were home, and although Mom was not in danger, she was still very trying. My dad had enough and just got up and left. He got into his little orange Nissan truck and drove away. I didn't realize he had left, thinking initially he had just ducked outside to have a smoke, but when he didn't come back in, I went outside to look for him and saw his truck was gone. I immediately felt fear creep over me. Dad had never done this before. Sure, times were extreme all too often, and I was constantly amazed at how he had always weathered every storm. Claimed that I wouldn't have blamed him if he ever threw in the towel, but always drew such comfort from the belief that he never would. Not Dad, not my superhero. Maybe he just went to the store for more cigs. Surely he would be back in a few minutes, but the minutes went by and he never returned. I don't remember how old I was at the time. I thought I was younger, but I must have just turned 16 because I could drive. I needed to go find my dad. We needed him. I needed him. Fortunately, we had a second car. It was a beater car for sure, but I didn't care. It worked, so I jumped in and started search. I don't know why, but I had a feeling I knew where he would go. In the town of Marysville, about 5 miles from our house, there was a lake called Ellis Lake. It was a place my dad would often go to think and sneak a smoke or three. It wasn't far from the mental health facility in town that he had frequented so many times over the years when Mom was being treated, so I think he found peace there. At least I hoped that was where he would go, because otherwise I had no idea. And if he was there, it possibly meant he had not left for good. Heading down D Street into town, just before turning left to go over the 10th Street Bridge, one can turn right onto 9th Street and head to the south end of the lake. It's a man-made lake with an easy walk surrounding the perimeter and benches placed randomly all along the way. I prayed I would see his truck parked somewhere and then would look for the closest bench. As I made the turn, the image that is forever baked into my mind's eye is one of what looked like a very frail, very old man hobbling across the street. He was aware of oncoming traffic, so he was trying to run to get out of the way, but he could only go so fast. I felt sorry for the man. Then I realized the old man was my old man. Being my superhero, my mental image of him was always this larger-than-life, strong, capable man. But here he was, clearly hampered physically, far from super. I quickly parked and ran back to where I hoped he would be. I was both relieved to find him on the nearby bench, but simultaneously so scared that he would tell me he wasn't coming back home. Although probably justifiable, God knows what he had endured for so many years, but there was no way we could make it without him. I sat next to him and meekly said hi. He looked so tired, I started to cry. I asked him if he was okay, and he genuinely seemed surprised that I was upset. He asked me why, and I shared that I was scared that he was leaving us. Now, my dad was not an overtly physically affectionate person. He loved us deeply, but it was more of a love that we just knew, not one that was often affirmed with physical gestures. But he knew how frightened I was, and he turned to me, putting his hand on my shoulder. It was trembling. I remember that. He looked me in the eye and said, "Son, I could never leave your mom or my boys. I just needed a break for a little bit, but I will be home soon." I asked him to promise he would come home, and he just nodded, but I believed him. He asked me to go back home to take care of mom, and he would see me in a little while. I drove home, and about an hour later, he pulled into the driveway as well. Dad never did that again. Today, whenever I am back in Marysville and drive past that lake, my memory returns to that evening. I see my dad running across the street, and I am sad when I think of the pain he was experiencing. But at the same time, I am filled with thankfulness for the blessing he truly was. He will forever be my superhero, human, but super all the same. Mike Tyson once said, "Everyone has a plan until they get punched in the nose." He was one bad dude, and he knew that many a soul could create a brave persona in their minds, but as soon as they felt the reality of a punch in the nose, they quickly came back to their mortal human self. I don't remember how old I was exactly. I think somewhere between 8 and 10 years, but I do remember clearly the experience. It probably comes as no surprise that a household filled with boys would include a couple pairs of boxing gloves. We had a space between our house and the neighbors that was probably 12 feet wide and maybe just as deep before reaching the backyard fence. One day, a few of the neighborhood kids were over and we decided to have a boxing match. My dad was there and he was going to referee the matches. He paired me and another boy my age named Kenny and instructed us we would go for 1 minute. I was a bit nervous since I had never really fought anyone before other than my brother, and that wasn't really fighting. And Kenny was known as a fairly quiet but tough kid in the neighborhood. We were friends, sort of, but certainly had never tested each other with our fists. Dad gave the verbal gong of the mythical bell, and Kenny and I started to fight. We were both a bit too selective in our punches to land many, or even throw more than a few, but I recall I got a few jabs in between my overly defensive posture. The minute elapsed, and Dad sounded the verbal gong again, ending the round. I was excited because I did better than I thought and even started to feel a bit cocky. When my dad suggested the round had been a tie and we should have a second round, I jumped at the chance to display my newfound pugilistic prowess. Then my dad walked over to me and gave me some ill-fated advice. He said it was time to unleash the windmill. Just go in there and start swinging like crazy, and I was sure to dominate Kenny. I was a bit surprised that the referee was giving me advice against my opponent, but with my confidence brimming, I thought, what the heck, go for it. Dad sounded the start of round two, and I went in swinging. Forget any defense, it was time to show this neighborhood tough guy just who he was messing with. I'm not sure how many swings I actually unleashed, but what I remember clearly was the smack in the nose Kenny landed on me. Just one, but that was enough. I was done. It hurt. And all my newfound confidence evaporated in an instant. Thanks for the advice, Dad. About a decade later, I was attending Chico State, and memories of that punch from Kenny had long been forgotten. I was in pretty decent shape, and for some reason still unknown to me, I wanted to try boxing. There was a boxing club on campus, and I knew a couple guys who spent time there, and they enjoyed it. I decided to give it a shot, but knew I needed to train quite a bit to get ready. Most importantly, I needed to lose weight. I was about 175 pounds at the time, and I decided I had my best chance of fighting around 150. Surely those little guys couldn't hurt me, and I'd gotten pretty proficient on the speed bag. I was working at a neighborhood liquor store, Spirits of America, and usually was the only one working during my shift. I usually ate there anyway since I didn't have much extra money in college, but now I decided the best way to eat but still lose weight was to simply not swallow. I could eat anything I wanted, chew it for the flavor, but then spit it into a brown paper bag and not add the calories. Genius. I was well on my way to my 150-pound goal and decided it was time to get in the ring and spar with someone. Ernie was one of my fraternity brothers and also in the boxing club. He was a little smaller than me, probably a natural 150-pounder, and he was a nice guy. Maybe because growing up he was always on the smaller size and got picked on, or maybe because he was a wrestler all through high school, who knows, but fighting seemed to come easy to him. Regardless, I thought I should be able to hold my own pretty well with Ernie, and it would be a good test, so we decided to spar a few rounds. I had an overhand right cross that was pretty effective, and for the first few moments, it easily found its target, which was Ernie's head. I think it caught Ernie off guard at first, but out of nowhere, he threw a straight right jab right square in my nose. That was it. Memories of my experience with Kenny a decade earlier came flooding back. My nose hurt, and I quit right then. Reality was laughing hard at me and taunting, "Take your dress and go home, sissy boy." I did. I don't often remember that experience with Ernie, but I do periodically hear my dad instructing me to implement the windmill. It's probably good advice in some situations. Going all in and giving it everything you have certainly is admirable, but just be prepared for a punch in the nose. They can come from anywhere. My dad has been gone now for over 2 decades. There may be a day now and then that passes that I do not think about him, but those are rare. When he was with us, he likely didn't realize just how much he impacted our lives. He did for sure, but thinking about it, his impact may have been even greater in the years since he passed. A while back, I found letters my mom wrote about me. I was the firstborn of 6, so mom still had the energy to do this sort of thing. She wrote a letter every year on my birthday, at least for the first several years. It was more of a journal since it wasn't to anyone in particular. I went through a phase when I was not very loving towards my parents. I wasn't overtly mean and was probably a typical youngster thinking my parents knew nothing and certainly weren't cool. But being the first child, this was all new to my dad, and I think I may have broken his heart more than once. When I read those letters, I cried. How could I have caused my dad such sadness? If he only knew how much I would grow to admire him, how much I would realize I love him. How much I wish he were still here so I could show him every day. When I was stupid young, I ran from him. Today I would use all my strength to run to him. I have so many questions for him. Some of these questions I was conscious of when he was still here. Some I never considered until later in life. Why didn't I ask them when I had the chance? I just need one more day with him. What was it like to be separated from your siblings at such a young age? How did he deal with the embarrassment of psoriasis that covered so much of his body that he needed to apply salve and wrap himself in plastic wrap from head to toe at night? What was it like dealing with public perception when he decided to date one of his students? He was very honorable, and the relationship was based on love since he eventually married our mom, staying true to her for over 40 years of marriage until the day he died. But that had to be hard, especially in those days. What were his life regrets? Did his boys make him proud? Did I make him proud? How? Why? What did he fear? Just being able to run my life choices past him now would be so comforting. I know I could trust he held no ulterior motives in his counsel. Why did it take me growing old to understand how valuable old wisdom can be? I really just need one more day with him. How far would I go to get one more day? What would I give up? I probably wouldn't give up my eyesight. And the impact music has on my soul, more than likely would prefer not to give up my hearing. But what about my ability to speak? Maybe. I could still communicate by writing. So yeah, maybe I would give up my ability to speak for something important. I would give it up if it gave my brother Mike his leg back, and his health. I would give it up for a chance to spend a day with my dad. I would hope it was worth a week, but I would take a day. I would give up a finger. It would have to be the right finger, though. I want to be able to signal certain things, like, it's okay, and what you can do to yourself if you are a bit of a turd. But I do have another hand, so maybe it doesn't matter. I would give a finger if I could help my brother Terry avoid the fear of losing his career late in life, or my brother Dan facing a fire that wiped out his house, or my brother Pat for things that I'm sure scared him, but I don't know what because he is so private, or help Tim avoid that scary walk to his Kitty Hawk assignment, and even Two Fingers if Mike could avoid diabetes. Then again, they are all stronger and better for those experiences, so maybe I'll keep my digits. Unless it made me a better bowler, I have seen Dan and Tim get scary good with the two-finger roll. I can imagine growing old with Dad. When I was less than half the legal drinking age, I do recall finding my dad's secret stash of gin and Tom Collins mix. It was high above the stove in a cupboard, and actually he rarely touched it. He rarely drank at all, but now and then he would have a Tom Collins. If he had two, it was obvious. Not in a bad way. He was just animated. It never dawned on me that he might have chosen that drink because his name was Tom. Then again, probably not. He just was never that focused on himself. I would sure love to belly up to a bar and share one with him now. One example that will forever burn bright in my heart is how much he loved his wife, our mom. No matter how challenging she made life, and she definitely could create obstacles, he just never wavered in his love for her. Thankfully, he didn't suffer from Alzheimer's. He passed too quickly and too young. But I could imagine him losing his memory, and even then, when all else seemed forgotten, just mentioning Mom, and surely his eyes would light up. How he loved her. And us. God, I miss him. I wish I would have known how much I would miss him when I still had him. I just need one more day to let him know. But then, that one day would only reveal even more just how special my dad was. Still is. Having that insight I would gain from my one extra day with him, I fear I would miss him even more than I do now. It would hurt too much. So I will just have to be satisfied with what I have now, a thankfulness for having him as my dad, unanswered questions and all. My dad wasn't perfect, but he was better than me. And if I just patterned my life after his, imperfect as he was, I would be a better me. What would Jesus do? Come on, he was God. But what would Dad do? Now that's a human I can shoot for. Darn it, Dad. You left too soon. I just need one more day. My life has been blessed in so many ways. That's not to say I haven't had my share of challenges, but the good has outweighed the bad to such a great degree. I know without a doubt there are at least a billion people that would trade me places on even my most trying day and would think they won the lottery. I am thankful every day for the path God has me walking. I have been very fortunate. My life has been filled with so many cool experiences, learning to fly a plane, skydive, scuba dive, paraglide, travel the world and visiting over 40 countries in my work, having multiple dogs and horses, surviving stage 4 cancer, surviving diverticulosis in a third world country. Okay, these last two are not really on anyone's bucket list, but just sharing to show what a varied and full life I have enjoyed. The list goes on and on. As a result, I am often asked, what is left on my bucket list? When I think about it, I never have had a bucket list. I didn't grow up with a passion for adventure or desire to travel. I don't think I even have adrenaline. I doze in the plane just before we jump, for gosh sakes. Things have just sort of worked out that way. I am far from a completed, fully evolved project, though. I laugh at the mere thought that the journey is nearing completion. In all honesty, it has only just started. If I did have a bucket list, it wouldn't be filled with experiences and certainly not a desire for material possessions. No, it would be focused more on ways I could improve as a person. In my mind, I can picture a version of me that I wish I could be. I wish I was more patient. I wish I could think before I speak and then be more sensitive with my words. No doubt, I care about people. I do. I have no hesitation sharing the many blessings God has bestowed on me, but often that kind of sharing, monetary or material possessions, are easy. Much more challenging would be to consistently, kindly listen and then reflecting carefully and thoughtfully before responding. A huge improvement would be evolving such that I could put myself in another's shoes and try imagining their perspective, especially when it conflicts with mine. I don't want to realize one day I have become that get off my lawn old guy. I will always be thankful for what I have and even more for what I can share. But my bucket list is short, a simple pursuit to be a kinder, gentler version, more open to differing perspectives, and counting to 10 before I speak. I have always been relatively healthy. Growing up one of six brothers, we all certainly had our fair share of bumps and bruises. Even my experiences that should have turned out much worse, like falling off a three-story house in college or developing diverticulitis in a third-world country, still only resulted in a few broken bones and an extremely painful but successful hospital stay, respectively. All in all, pretty tame. So it usually comes as a surprise when I share that for some unknown reason, I just always knew one day I would have cancer. It wasn't a morbid prediction, nor did it consume me with fear. I rarely thought about it. It was just a distant feeling. My 51st birthday had just been celebrated, and I was cruising through life. Then, for some unknown reason, I reached deep in my throat and discovered a lump. No pain, no discomfort, no reason to be sticking my finger that far back at all. I almost forgot about it until I was at a routine dentist appointment. Almost as an afterthought, I asked my dentist to check it out. He thought it was quite unremarkable. But just to be safe, he recommended I go see an ENT doc friend of his. But it was probably nothing. With no sense of urgency, I reached out to his friend and scheduled an appointment. The ENT doc was a nice guy, and his quick assessment was that it was likely nothing to be concerned about, but let's take a biopsy just to be sure. He took a sample and said he would call me in a week. The next day, while shopping at Costco, I was a bit surprised to get a call, and caller ID announced it was my ENT doc. The call that was supposed to come in a week was now ringing after only one day. I answered, and in my best Bugs Bunny tone asked, "What's up, doc?" He greeted me and then followed with a very succinct, "You have cancer." No lead up, no small talk, just very direct, but also very calm. I asked if it was the bad kind, and he said, "Well, there isn't a good kind," but that he was sure we caught it very early and likely would only need a simple surgery to remove it. He said I needed to come in for a PET scan to make sure, but didn't seem worried. He was sure it was stage one at worst. I was able to go in for the scan right away, and afterward, they said they would reach out to me with the results in a few days. I know it should probably have been more worrisome, but for some reason, I just wasn't alarmed. Well, until the call that was supposed to come in a few days came that very next morning. I asked what the results were, and they said I needed to come in that day to see the oncologist. I asked if they could give me a hint, and they said best to just come in. When I got there, I met with the oncologist who asked me what I knew. I shared that my understanding was that although it was cancer, it was still in very early stages and could likely be removed with a simple surgery. He very calmly said no, that it was stage four, and that it had spread through the lymph nodes in my neck, and I was not a candidate for surgery. I needed to start chemotherapy and radiation right away. But he also said that treatment had advanced tremendously in the last couple of years and my chances were much better. I wasn't sure how to interpret that, so I asked what my prognosis was. He said with a huge smile that he was optimistic and felt comfortable that my chance for recovery might even be as high as 50-50. I let that soak in for a moment, then blurted out, 50-50? And that's an improvement? What would they have been a year or two ago? He said 90-10 and not in my favor. Now I could see why he was so happy. I left his office and sat in my car. It dawned on me that I probably should have brought someone to me to this appointment. At that moment, I felt quite alone. I wasn't sure how to share this life-changing discovery with my family or loved ones. It all seemed a bit surreal, yet at the same time, not unexpected. Weird, I know. I knew I had a tough road ahead, but I also felt a strange comfort that it would all be okay. I had complete trust in God's plan for me, whatever that might be. So figured let's just go get after it. Looking back, I also had no clue what was coming. What I hadn't anticipated was the abundance of blessings that I would encounter along my path to recovery. Yes, I did fully recover. The journey wasn't easy and in fact was very tough and touch and go for a while. But all the pain and misery paled in comparison to the love and support I was blessed with along the way. Family and friends who came to my rescue, giving up vacation days, some traveling many miles to share the load of driving me to treatment daily, making sure I was getting the nutrients I desperately needed through my feeding tube because I lost the ability to swallow early on, unselfishly cleaning me up after the multiple vomiting sessions I would enjoy each day, making me go to daily treatment even when I was giving up, and praying for me constantly. I would mention my saviors by name, but you know who you are. I know who you are. I will never forget you. Each one of you, truly blessings. Maybe one day I'll write a book chronicling my journey, and then I can give each of you the credit you deserve. People ask me if I had a different outlook on life after my experience. Honestly, not really. I was already blessed with an optimistic view of life before, and my faith was strong. I did have a newfound realization that God had prepared me, though. I was lucky to have been given parents who led by example when dealing with the many hardships they encountered. So many times when their struggles seemed at their darkest hour, I was amazed at how they found such strength in just giving it to God and trusting. So many times when my fight seemed at its fiercest moment, I drew upon their example. My mom, especially, had consistently demonstrated such an amazing faith when confronted with her demons. She easily could have, should have, felt sorry for herself and complained about how life was so unfair. Instead, she simply gave thanks for the challenges, claiming they were such a wonderful opportunity to show God her faith. Little did I know then how much strength I would derive from her example when I needed it most. I also simply felt very blessed to have had cancer, because it was only through that experience that I was able to realize just how deep and unwavering the love was from my family, loved ones, and friends. It would have been so easy for any of them to feign caring, but hope that someone else stepped up to help. But none of them faltered. Everyone rising above and beyond to help me through to the finish line. Such blessings, each one of them. I wouldn't wish cancer on anyone. Survival is not guaranteed, often not even likely, and the pain along the way is no fun. But it can also be a blessing in many ways. I know mine was. Thank God.
For as long as I can remember, when I asked my brother, "Kevin, how are you?" he would always say, "Blessed." The response was immediate, honest, and genuine. He truly believed it. What a blessing he still is to us today, being in heaven, looking down upon us, advocating for us, and praying for us. He would want us to know just how truly special we are, and that we are loved truly.